sword in hand, David stood in the hushed darkness, mere steps away from his mortal enemy, who had been caught unawares in the most inglorious of positions, squatting on with his pants on the ground against the wall of the cave. Out in the light of day, Saul's trained soldiers outnumbered David's band of disaffected fugitives, about 5-1. But in the dark, honeycombed networks of the cave that just happened to hide David and his 600-odd men, Saul was alone and unprotected. What's a guy got to do for a little privacy around here? This was supposed to be the wilderness, right? In the months since he'd been forced to flee from Saul's murderous jealousy, David had been constantly on the move, able to stay only just ahead of the king's pursuit. Saul, meanwhile, had left behind a path of destruction in his wake, succeeding only in driving more and more of his own subjects to seek refuge with David. At Nob, where David had taken on provisions in the first days of his flight, Saul had come and first interrogated the residents of the village, and then he had ordered the 80-some priests who lived there, together with their wives and children and even their animals, to be slaughtered. Once word spread of the massacre at Nob, no town would risk offering David refuge. Some even kept Saul appraised of David's movements so that their loyalty to the paranoid king would be above reproach. David discreetly moved his family out of the country, placing them in the protection of the king of Moab, the homeland of David's great-grandmother Ruth. And then David and his followers, they took to the wilderness, to the arid hill country of south-central Judah and the rocky, defensible strongholds of the Dead Sea region. Narrowly eluding capture in the Maon Desert when Saul was called away to deal with a Philistine threat, David had moved his band to En-Gedi, where the numerous caves would afford a suitable hiding place and the oasis would provide much-needed food and water for his weary men. This is where Saul and his 3,000 picked soldiers finally caught up with David, near a place called the Crags of the Wild Goats. David was well hid, but grossly outnumbered. Had it been a detachment of soldiers that had discovered them hiding in the cave that day, David and his band would have been finished. But instead, it was Saul himself, alone, unarmed, just looking for a place to do his business. Suddenly and unexpectedly, the tables had turned. The Lord himself had delivered Saul into David's hands. David had only to bring down his sword, and Saul's reign of terror would be over. The 600-some occupants of the cave would be free to come out of hiding. David could take his rightful place as the Lord's anointed king. This, after all, was what God had promised. He was tearing the kingdom away from Saul, as the old prophet Samuel had predicted, in order to give it to someone better. A man after God's own heart. This is the day the Lord spoke of, his followers urged him. He's given your enemy into your hand for you to do with him what you wish. Standing there in the darkness, poised to strike, David recalled the day that Samuel had come to his father's house in Bethlehem. He'd come secretly with a horn of oil to anoint Saul's replacement as king. David had just been a boy. He wasn't even there when his brothers Eliab and Abinadab and Shammah were presented to the prophet. He was out in the pastures tending the sheep. But when Samuel didn't find what he was looking for among any of David's 7 brothers, David too had been brought in from the fields. For some reason, he, of all of them, was the chosen one. People look at the outward appearance, Samuel had declared, as he poured the fragrant oil over David's head. But the Lord looks at the heart. David wondered what the prophet had said to Saul at his anointing, once a surprised and reluctant farm boy himself. For all his faults, David remembered, the Lord had chosen Saul once too. Stealthily, David crept up next to Saul. Swiftly and silently, he made a stroke with his sword and retreated into the recesses of the cavern. David's men were incredulous. They had expected their leader to return with the tyrant's head, but all that David held in his hand was a corner of Saul's ornamented robe. A golden opportunity like this would not come again. David's hot-headed nephews, Abishai and Joab, very nearly had to be physically restrained from tearing out of their hiding place after the king. "He's the Lord's anointed," David said, trying to explain. He was thinking to himself, "Just like me." The moment had passed. Saul was gone, and with him, any hope for an immediate end to this standoff. Then an idea seized David. With several quick strides, he was at the mouth of the cave, and before anyone hardly knew what was happening, David had called out to Saul, "My lord the king!" What was he doing? Not only had David missed his chance to seize the throne, but now he was taking his life in his hands. Not to mention, he risked revealing the hiding place of all of those who had entrusted themselves to his protection. "My lord the king!" David repeated. Startled, Saul turned back toward the cave and saw David bowing face down to the ground. "Why do you listen to those who tell you that I mean you harm?" David asked as he stood again to his feet. "You can see with your own eyes how the Lord delivered you into my hands in the cave." He raised the corner cut from Saul's robe above his head for the king to see. And a chill went down Saul's spine as he realized just how close he had been to death. "Some urged me to kill you just now," David went on, "but I spared you because I would not raise my hand against the Lord's anointed." I don't have to tell you, Saul did not believe what he was hearing. "Is that your voice, David, my son?" he called, as if awakened from a dream. It was like a spell had been lifted. The king fell to the ground and wept. When a man finds his enemy, does he let him get away unharmed? He asked, dumbfounded. "You are more righteous than I. You've treated me well, but I've treated you badly." Then the king uttered words that no one, not even David, had expected to hear from his mouth. "I know now that surely you will be king," he said. "And the kingdom of Israel will be established in your hands." It was a startling admission from the very person who had been most at pains to deny this truth. Saul had acknowledged that David would indeed succeed him as king. And you know, David too had acknowledged this truth in a new way. In the cave, standing over Saul, he had recognized that he did not need to take from Saul what God had already promised would be his when the time was right. David didn't need to take matters into his own hands. His time would come. Saul called off his pursuit and returned home to Gibeah. But David and his men retreated to another of their rock-top strongholds. Saul had changed his mind about David before, and no doubt he would again. Saul would be back in good time, and this scene would replay itself before David could safely come out of hiding. But for now, he was content to wait on God's timing. Throughout the books of Samuel, one theme that emerges again and again is that David refuses to take the throne of Israel by force or to take matters into his own hands. Twice, David is presented with a golden opportunity like this to kill Saul and eliminate his rival. And twice, despite the insistence of his followers, he refuses to lift his hands against the Lord's anointed. Eventually, Saul is killed in battle with the Philistines. But even then, David refuses to celebrate. Instead, he composes a lament to mourn the loss of the man who'd been trying for years to get him killed. Again And again, over the course of the years that follow, David is content to allow God to deal with his enemies and rivals in his own way and in his own time. David will not be responsible for shedding their blood. As David Gunn puts it, he will not grasp, but he will have the crown only as a gift. 1,000 years later, David's most famous descendant, Jesus, would spend some time in the wilderness as well. The Bible tells us that during that time, he was tempted or tested by the devil before beginning his ministry. 3 times, Satan gave Jesus the opportunity to choose his own way over God's way, his timing over God's timing, his will over God's will. When Jesus hadn't eaten in many days, the devil said, "Turn these stones into loaves of bread." He said, "Make a public display of your divinity and people will follow you." He said, "Bow down to me and I'll give you all the kingdoms of the world." In each case, it strikes me that Satan didn't attempt to seduce Jesus to desire all the wrong things, but rather to take matters into his own hands and seize the right things at the wrong time or in the wrong way. Jesus would eat when his testing was over, but he wouldn't use his power to satisfy his own desires. He'd work miracles again and again throughout his ministry, but he'd do so out of compassion, not as a self-serving public spectacle. And he would receive glory and honor and power and authority over every kingdom in this world, but not before he would die for this world and rise again. Jesus refused to take matters into his own hands, choosing instead to trust his Father's will and timing. I think David must have recognized on some level that day in the cave that what everyone around him called a golden opportunity was in fact a test. Would he take matters into his own hands and seize power? Would he wait on God's timing and receive it as a gift? What would his actions in the cave say about his character and the kind of king he would become? So what about you? We all have goals and plans and aspirations, whether in the short term or the long term. You may have some hopes and plans for this afternoon, and you may have some hopes and plans for 5 or 10 or 20 years from now. God has a plan, too, a purpose for you. Plans to prosper you and not to harm you, as the prophet Jeremiah puts it. Plans to give you a future and a hope. The problem is sometimes you and I can begin to confuse our plans with God's plans, to think that they're the same or that we've got God's intentions and timing all figured out. In the Bible, more often than not, God's plans and promises tend to involve a lot of waiting and a lot of trusting. From Abraham to Moses and from David to Jesus, God's purposes unfold slowly but surely. While those who take matters into their own hands and try to help God along by grasping at whatever happens to be within reach tend to shut themselves off from the good gifts that God wants to give. Standing there in the dark of the cave, David made a choice. Not to take for himself what he had been promised, but to wait on God's timing. May we all experience more of the surrendered heart of David, to know as he did that God will do all things in his time.